and a low of 33, winds up to 25 miles per hour. Right now, pretty nice. Wind east at 7, 38 degrees were seen, 37 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I hope that you were able to hear yesterday's morning show when I spoke with Donna Rubin, the author of a fascinating new book called Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women. On today's program, you're going to be hearing actual recorded excerpts from five of those notable speeches. And I'll be sharing a part of the introductions that Donna Rubin has written for each of them. We begin with a speech delivered in the spring of 1947. And here is some of what Donna Rubin has to say about this amazing speech and the amazing woman who delivered it. Donna Rubin writes, "Catherine Hepburn's leftist leanings surprised no one. She'd been raised in a progressive household with radical thinkers, writers, and artists at the dinner table. She stumped for Franklin D. Roosevelt and lent her name to Russian war relief efforts. What astonished people was the blistering force of her attack on the enemies of freedom in the spring of 1947. Silence the artist and you silence the most articulate voice people have, she thundered to a crowd of 28,000 at a rally supporting the 1948 Progressive Party presidential candidate Henry Wallace. Hepburn was infuriated that Representative J. Parnell Thomas, chairman of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, had begun investigating communist activity in Hollywood. Again and again, she attacked HUAC's assault on liberty, pointing to attempts to suppress speech in the theater, literature, education, art, and the movies. Hepburn's younger brother Bob later said his sister's famous speech was, in his words, made for mother. This would be a reference to Kit Hepburn, a passionate social reformer, suffragist, and birth control supporter who worked closely with Margaret Sanger. Here is some of that speech delivered by Katharine Hepburn on May 19th, 1947.
In democratic United States, in the year of 1947, supposedly responsible government officials call for the outlawing of minority political parties and blithely ignore the freedom-shattering implication of their hysterical request. The President of the United States calls for a loyalty check, which can only be compared to the thought police of Imperial Japan when that country followed the fascist path to destruction and war. But the American people are not so gullible. They have proved in the past that they do not take kindly to the tactics of demagogues and organized parties of reaction. In the period immediately following the First World War, the Attorney General of the United States, one A. Mitchell Palmer, attempted to make political capital of terror and repression. His Justice Department swooped down upon and arrested thousands of innocent persons whose only crime was an alien status or holding a divergent political view from those of Mr. Palmer. However, Mitchell Palmer's presidential hopes faded with the rising tide of protest from the appalled public. And the party which instituted the political raids was defeated in the next national election. Today, J. Parnell Thomas of the Un-American Activities Committee is engaged in a personally conducted smearing campaign of the motion picture industry. He is aided and abetted in this effort by a group of Hollywood super patriots who call themselves the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. For myself, I want no part of their ideals nor those of Mr. Thomas. Suffice it to say that on June 28, 1944, shortly after the formation of the Motion Picture Alliance, approximately 1,000 member delegates of 17 motion picture guilds and unions met to repudiate this organization and everything for which it stands. The validity of this action can be judged by the recent activities of the Alliance. They have enthusiastically supported the Rankin Thomas Committee, and their executive secretary, Dr. John Lechner, took the liberty of releasing a list of films which were called subversive. Among the so-called subversive pictures are, get this, The Best Years of Our Lives, Pride of the Marines, The Strange Love of Martha Ivers, Boomerang, and Margie. The members of the Alliance, the Thomases, Rankins, and Tennies, are concerned about the best years of our lives. This is a touching concern. No doubt. But why do the Thomases, the Rankins and Tennies, and their bosses express no concern over the fate of the American people who face growing unemployment and a terrible depression? Their loud cries can be heard from one end of the country to the other, bewailing the danger of a book on democracy or a play about Negroes. But they are strangely silent on the subject of housing. Which of them has ever raised voice for full employment, an adequate health program, and security for the American people? Who among them has cried the evils of discrimination against minorities or protested the futile anti-labor legislation just passed by the Congress? And where do these men stand in the fight for peace? To achieve peace and lasting prosperity, there must be unity among us and among all the nations of the world. The same unity that won the war. America became great, not because of the Salem witch hunt, but in spite of them. We are still great because the American people have always accepted the challenge of new ideas from the day that freedom was born in 1776 to this very moment. The American people eagerly grasped at fresh concepts when they created this nation. The men and women who rode covered wagons across the plains followed the road of vigor and youth to new freedom and a fuller life. The path of middle-aged thinking not only sets back the clock, it leads only to the grave. And today, we won't turn the clock back, and we won't stand still. We'll move forward, progressively forward. That is what the American people have always done. We will fight not only to prevent the abridgment of freedom, but to broaden the freedoms that already exist. We will fight not only for what we have and hold dear, but for what we hope to have, and deserve to have, and can have. And that is why we are here tonight.
From May 19th, 1947, Katharine Hepburn. You're listening to a special morning show on WGTD, a follow-up to Tuesday's conversation with Donna Rubin, the author of the book Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women. The next speech was delivered in the summer of 1974 by one Barbara Jordan. Here is some of what Donna Rubin has to say. Already a distinguished politician in her home state of Texas, it was not until she landed a primetime spot in the impeachment trial of President Nixon that Barbara Jordan, Democratic member of Congress, was thrust into the national spotlight. On a July evening in 1974, after a 12-hour debate, Jordan introduced the articles of impeachment to members of the House Judiciary Committee and a nationally televised audience. But before she turned to the question of the hour, whether Nixon committed impeachable crimes in the Watergate scandal, she intended to clarify her relationship to the principles upon which that assessment would be based. Here is Barbara Jordan from July 25th, 1974.
Earlier today, we heard the beginning of the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. We the people. It's a very eloquent beginning. But when that document was completed on the 17th of September in 1787, I was not included in that we the people. I felt somehow for many years that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton just left me out by mistake. But through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in we the people. Today, I am an inquisitor. And hyperbole would not be fictional and would not overstate the solemnness that I feel right now. My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution. Who can so properly be the inquisitors for the nation as the representatives of the nation themselves? The subjects of its jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men. And that's what we're talking about. In other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. It is wrong, I suggest, it is a misreading of the Constitution for any member here to assert that for a member to vote for an article of impeachment means that that member must be convinced that the president should be removed from office. The Constitution doesn't say that. The powers relating to impeachment are an essential check in the hands of the body, the legislature, against and upon the encroachments of the executive. The division between the two branches of the legislature, the House and the Senate, assigning to the one the right to accuse and to the other the right to judge. The framers of this Constitution were very astute. They did not make the accusers and the judges the same person. We know the nature of impeachment. We've been talking about it a while now. It is chiefly designed for the president and his high ministers to somehow be called into account. It is designed to bridle the executive if he engages in excesses. It is designed as a method of national inquest into the conduct of public men. The framers confided in the Congress the power, if need be, to remove the president in order to strike a delicate balance between a president swollen with power and grown tyrannical and preservation of the independence of the executive. The nature of impeachment, a narrowly channeled exception to the separation of powers maxim. The Federal Convention of 1787 said that. It limited impeachment to high crimes and misdemeanors and discounted and opposed the term maladministration. It is to be used only for great misdemeanors, so it was said in the North Carolina Ratification Convention. And in the Virginia Ratification Convention, we do not trust our liberty to a particular branch. We need one branch to check the other. No one need be afraid. The North Carolina Ratification Convention, no one need be afraid that officers who commit oppression will pass with immunity. The Constitution charges the president with the task of taking care that the laws be faithfully executed. And yet, the president has counseled his aides to commit perjury, willfully disregard the secrecy of grand jury proceedings, conceal surreptitious entry, attempt to compromise a federal judge, while publicly displaying his cooperation with the processes of criminal justice. A president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. If the impeachment provision in the Constitution of the United States will not reach the offenses charged here, then perhaps that 18th century Constitution should be abandoned to a 20th century paper shredder. Has the president committed offenses and planned and directed and acquiesced in a course of conduct which the Constitution will not tolerate? That's the question. We know that. We know the question. We should now forthwith proceed to answer the question. It is reason and not passion which must guide our deliberations, guide our debate, and guide our decision. I yield back the balance of my time, Mr. Chairman.
Barbara Jordan delivered these remarks on July 25th, 1974. You're listening to a special edition of The Morning Show on WGTD, a follow-up to my conversation yesterday with Donna Rubin, author of an amazing new book called Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women. Next is a speech delivered on August 19, 1992, to the Republican National Convention in Houston's Astrodome. And here is some of what Donna Rubin has to say about Mary Fisher and this extraordinary moment. Mary Fisher's life was a postcard of a certain kind of success. White, upper class, educated, the daughter of a wealthy Detroit financier and Republican power broker. One summer day in 1991, her ex-husband called to say he had been feeling sick, had taken a blood test for HIV, and tested positive. She was tested, too. At a payphone at LaGuardia Airport, she got the results and was ambushed by a positive test and a terminal prognosis. At that time, to be diagnosed with AIDS was more than a death sentence. It also meant blame and rejection. At first, she felt paralyzed, then determined to change the story. She wanted to bring home the reality of AIDS to ordinary people and to people in power. Mary Fisher urged unity. This disease, she said, does not care whether you are Democratic or Republican. It does not ask whether you are black or white, male or female, gay or straight, young or old. Here is a part of Mary Fisher's speech given on August 19th, 1992.
The lesson history teaches is this: if you believe you are safe, you are at risk. If you do not see this killer stalking your children, look again. There is no family or community, no race or religion, no place left in America that is safe. Until we genuinely embrace this message, we are a nation at risk. Tonight, HIV marches resolutely toward AIDS in more than a million American homes, littering its pathway with the bodies of the young, young men, young women, young parents, and young children. One of the families is mine. If it is true that HIV inevitably turns to AIDS, then my children will inevitably turn to orphans. My family has been a rock of support. My 84-year-old father, who has pursued the healing of the nations, will not accept the premise that he cannot heal his daughter. My mother refuses to be broken. She still calls at midnight to tell wonderful jokes that make me laugh. Sisters and friends and my brother Philip, whose birthday is today, all have helped carry me over the hardest places. I am blessed, richly and deeply blessed, to have such a family. But not all of you. But not all of you have been so blessed. You are HIV positive, but dare not say it. You have lost loved ones, but you dared not whisper the word AIDS. You weep silently. You grieve alone. I have a message for you. It is not you who should feel shame. It is we. We who tolerate ignorance and practice prejudice. We who have taught you to fear. We must lift our shroud of silence, making it safe for you to reach out for compassion. It is our task to seek safety for our children, not in quiet denial, but in effective action. Someday our children will be grown. My son Max, now 4, will take the measure of his mother. My son Zachary, now 2, will sort through his memories. I may not be here to hear their judgments, but I know already what I hope they are. I want my children to know that their mother was not a victim. She was a messenger. I do not want them to think, as I once did, that courage is the absence of fear. I want them to know that courage is the strength to act wisely when most we are afraid. I want them to have the courage to step forward when called by their nation or their party and give leadership, no matter what the personal cost. I ask no more of you than I ask of myself or of my children. To the millions of you who are grieving, who are frightened, who have suffered the ravages of AIDS firsthand, have courage and you will find support. To the millions who are strong, I issue the plea: set aside prejudice in politics to make room for compassion and sound policy. children, I make this pledge. I will not give in, Zachary, because I draw my courage from you. Your silly giggle gives me hope. Your gentle prayers give me strength. And you, my child, give me the reason to say to America, you are at risk. And I will not rest, Max, until I have done all I can to make your world safe. I will seek a place where intimacy is not the prelude to suffering. I will not hurry to leave you, my children. But when I go, I pray that you will not suffer shame on my account. To all within the sound of my voice, I appeal. Learn with me the lessons of history and of grace, so my children will not be afraid to say the word AIDS when I am gone. Then their children and yours may not need to whisper it at all. God bless the children, and God bless us all. Good night.
An excerpt from the speech delivered by Mary Fisher to the Republican National Convention in August of 1992. I'm happy to report that Mary Fisher has managed to defy that terminal prognosis and is still alive and still an impassioned AIDS activist all these years later. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This is a special follow-up to yesterday's morning show, a conversation with Donna Rubin, the author of an amazing new book called Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women. Next is an excerpt from the commencement address delivered at City College of New York in the spring of 2016 by then First Lady Michelle Obama. Much discussion and quite a lot of criticism was prompted by the First Lady's reference to her living with her husband and two daughters in a historic house built by slaves. Many Americans insisted that it could not be true. Donna Rubin writes, "In fact, it was true. The labor force that worked on the construction site beginning in 1792 was made up of both free and enslaved blacks, plus local white laborers and immigrants from Scotland and Ireland. As the White House Historical Association was quick to point out, the federal government did not actually own enslaved people, but it did hire them from their masters." Obama's story lifted the curtain on something we thought we already knew and revealed it to have a sinister side. Her anecdote hit many people hard because it seemed to undercut a cherished national monument. But the opposite is also true. It celebrated the progress this country has made as black Americans have gone from enslaved laborers to residents whose children innocently play with their dogs on the lawn. Here is part of Michelle Obama's commencement address at City College of New York on June 3rd, 2016.
As many of you knew, I grew up in a working-class family in Chicago. And while neither of my parents went past high school, let me tell you, they saved up every penny that my dad earned at his city job because they were determined to send me to college. And even after my father was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and he struggled to walk, relying on crutches just to get himself out of bed each morning, my father hardly ever missed a day of work. See, that blue-collar job helped to pay the small portion of my college tuition that wasn't covered by loans or grants or my work study or my summer jobs. And my dad was so proud to pay that tuition bill on time each month, even taking out loans when he fell short. See, he never wanted me to miss a registration deadline because his check was late. That's my story. And graduates, you all have faced challenges far greater than anything I or my family have ever experienced. challenges that most college students could never even imagine. Some of you have been homeless. Some of you have risked the rejection of your families to pursue your education. Many of you have lain awake at night wondering how on earth you were going to support your parents and your kids and still pay tuition. And many of you know what it's like to live not just month to month or day to day, but meal to meal. But graduates, let me tell you, you should never, ever be embarrassed by those struggles. You should never view your challenges as a disadvantage. Instead, it's important for you to understand that your experience facing and overcoming adversity is actually one of your biggest advantages. And I know that because I've seen it myself, not just as a student working my way through school, but years later, before I came to the White House and I worked as a dean at a college, in that role, I encountered students who had every advantage. Their parents paid their full tuition. They lived in beautiful campus dorms. They had every material possession a college kid could want, cars, computers, spending money. But when some of them got their first bad grade, they just fell apart. They lost it because they were ill-equipped to handle their first encounter with disappointment or falling short. But graduates, as you all know, life will put many obstacles in your path that are far worse than a bad grade. You'll have unreasonable bosses and difficult clients and patients. You'll experience illnesses and losses, crises and setbacks that will come out of nowhere and knock you off your feet. But unlike so many other young people, you have already developed the resilience and the maturity that you need to pick yourself up and dust yourself off and keep moving through the pain. Keep moving forward. You have developed that muscle. And with the education you've gotten at this fine school and the experiences you've had in your lives, let me tell you, nothing, and I mean nothing, is going to stop you from fulfilling your dreams. And you deserve every last one of the successes that I know you will have. But I also want to be very clear that with those successes comes a set of obligations to share the lessons you've learned here at this school, the obligation to use the opportunities you've had to help others. That means raising your hand when you get a seat in that board meeting and asking the question, well, whose voices aren't being heard here? What ideas are we missing? It means adding your voice to our national conversation, speaking out for our most cherished values of liberty, opportunity, inclusion, and respect, the values that you've been living here at this school. It means reaching back to help young people who've been left out and left behind, helping them prepare for college, helping them pay for college, making sure that great public universities like this one have the funding and support that they need. Because we all know that public universities have always been one of the greatest drivers of our prosperity, lifting countless people into the middle class, creating jobs and wealth all across this nation. Public education is our greatest pathway to opportunity in America. So we need to invest in and strengthen our public universities today and for generations to come. That is how you will do your part to live up to the oath that you all will take here today. The oath taken by generations of graduates before you to make your city and your world greater, better, and more beautiful. More than anything else, graduates, that is the American story. It's your story and the story of those who came before you at this school. It's the story of the son of Polish immigrants named Jonas Salk, who toiled for years in a lab until he discovered a vaccine that saved countless lives. It's the story of the son of immigrant Jamaican immigrants named Colin Powell, who became a four-star general, Secretary of State, and a role model for young people across the country. And graduates, it's the story that I witness every single day when I wake up in a house that was built by slaves, and I watch my daughters, two beautiful black young women, head off to school, waving goodbye to their father, the President of the United States, the son of a man from Kenya who came here to America for the same reasons as many of you, to get an education and improve his prospects in life. So graduates, while I think it's fair to say that our founding fathers never could have imagined this day, all of you are very much the fruits of their vision. Their legacy is very much your legacy and your inheritance. And don't let anybody tell you differently. You are the living, breathing proof that the American dream endures in our time. It's you. So I want you all to go out there, be great, build great lives for yourself, enjoy the liberties that you have in this great country, pursue your own version of happiness, and please, please always, always do your part to help others do the same. I love you all. I am so proud of you. Thank you for allowing me to share this final commencement with you. I have so much faith in who you will be. Just keep working hard and keep the faith. I can't wait to see what you all achieve in the years ahead. Thank you all. God bless. Good luck on the road ahead.
Then First Lady Michelle Obama, in an excerpt from her commencement address at City College of New York on June 3, 2016. To finish out this special morning show, a follow-up to yesterday's conversation with Donna Rubin, author of Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women, we turn to the one and only Oprah Winfrey. Here is portion of her acceptance speech for the Cecil B. DeMille Award presented to her at the 75th Annual Golden Globes, which was just 3 months after the New York Times expose revealing numerous sexual abuse allegations against film producer Harvey Weinstein. Donna Rubin writes, "In your mind's eye, you can just see that little girl sitting on the linoleum floor in her mother's house, watching Sidney Poitier accept an Oscar at the 1964 Academy Awards. His tie was white, and of course his skin was black," she said, "and she had never seen a black man being celebrated like that." That little girl became the woman we know as Oprah Winfrey, and until the Golden Globes in 2018, when she gave this speech, we had never seen a black woman being celebrated while speaking out quite like that. That is the power of storytelling, the kind that makes you feel you are inside the little girl's head. And it's key to what makes Oprah such an exceptionally gifted communicator.
In 1964, I was a little girl sitting on the linoleum floor of my mother's house in Milwaukee, watching Anne Bancroft present the Oscar for Best Actor at the 36th Academy Awards. She opened the envelope and said five words that literally made history. The winner is Sidney Poitier. Up to the stage came the most elegant man I had ever seen. I remember his tie was white, and of course his skin was black, and I'd never seen a black man being celebrated like that. And I have tried many, many, many times to explain what a moment like that means to a little girl, a kid watching from the cheap seats, as my mom came through the door bone-tired from cleaning other people's houses. But all I can do is quote and say that the explanation in Sydney's performance in Lilies of the Field, amen, 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 amen. In 1982, Sydney received the Cecil B. DeMille Award right here at the Golden Globes, and it is not lost on me that at this moment, there are some little girls watching as I become the first black woman to be given the same award. It is an honor. It is an honor, and it is a privilege to share the evening with all of them, and also with the incredible men and women who've inspired me, who've challenged me, who've sustained me, and made my journey to this stage possible. Dennis Swanson, who took a chance on me for AM Chicago. Quincy Jones, who saw me on that show and said to Steven Spielberg, yes, she is Sophia in The Color Purple. Gail, who's been the definition of what a friend is, and Stedman, who's been my rock, just a few to name. I'd like to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, because we all know that the press is under siege these days. But we also know that it is the insatiable dedication to uncovering the absolute truth that keeps us from turning a blind eye to corruption and to injustice. To tyrants and victims and secrets and lies. I want to say that I value the press more than ever before as we try to navigate these complicated times, which brings me to this. What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. Each of us in this room are celebrated because of the stories that we tell. And this year, we became the story. But it's not just a story affecting the entertainment industry. It's one that transcends any culture, geography, race, religion, politics, or workplace. So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue. They're the women whose names we'll never know. They are domestic workers and farm workers. They are working in factories, and they work in restaurants, and they're in academia and engineering and medicine and science. They're part of the world of tech and politics and business. There are athletes in the Olympics, and there are soldiers in the military. And there's someone else, Reese Taylor, a name I know and I think you should know too. In 1944, Reese Taylor was a young wife and a mother. She was just walking home from a church service. She'd attended in Abbeville, Alabama, when she was abducted by six armed white men, raped and left blindfolded by the side of the road, coming home from church. They threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone. But her story was reported to the NAACP, where a young worker by the name of Rosa Parks became the lead investigator on her case. And together, they sought justice. But justice wasn't an option in the era of Jim Crow. The men who tried to destroy her were never persecuted. Reese Taylor died 10 days ago, just shy of her 98th birthday. She lived, as we all have lived, too many years in a culture broken by brutally powerful men. For too long, women have not been heard or believed if they dared to speak their truth to the power of those men. But their time is up. The time is up. The time is up. And I just hope that Recy Taylor died knowing that her truth, like the truth of so many other women who were tormented in those years, and even now tormented, goes marching on. It was somewhere in Rosa Parks' heart almost 11 years later when she made the decision to stay seated on that bus in Montgomery. And it's here with every woman who chooses to say, me too. And every man who chooses to listen. In my career, what I've always tried my best to do, whether on television or through film, is to say something about how men and women really behave, to say how we experience shame, how we love and how we rage, how we fail, how we retreat, persevere, and how we overcome. And I've interviewed and portrayed people who've withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you, but the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning, even during our darkest nights. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say me too again. Thank you.
Oprah Winfrey speaking at the Golden Globes on January 7th, 2018. The text for this and 74 other speeches are gathered together in Donna Rubin's amazing new book called Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women, the likes of Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Sojourner Truth, Clara Barton, Helen Keller, closer to our own day, Rachel Carson, Josephine Baker, Sandra Day O'Connor, Gloria Steinem, Temple Grandin, and many more. The book is published by Real Clear Publishing, and I highly recommend it. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program, and we'll be hearing tomorrow about some of the exciting things going on at the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center. And on Friday, an interesting conversation about archaeology from Donald P. Lang, the author of the book Beneath the Sands of Egypt. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast calls for partly cloudy skies today and mild conditions with a high of 43 degrees. Overnight, clouds increasing, a low of 33. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 40. And then a winter storm watch goes into effect. Looks like right now it will mostly be going into effect Friday morning. And we could see significant snowfall, possibly even 8 to 9 inches of snow and some high winds. Could be a messy Friday. That would be a Thursday night going into Friday morning. Friday's high 37. This is WGTD HD Kenosha.